Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is God's Gumshoe, and this is an investigation into the New Testament Bible. Today, we're continuing on with our investigation into the miracles of Jesus, Part 3. Earlier in this series, about two or three episodes back, we spoke of David Hume as the philosopher who many say had the last word on the miraculous. Well, today we're going to address that. We're going to address that in two parts. First, we're going to continue with the debate about miracles, and then we're going to continue on with the investigation of the miracles of Jesus, as understood by the Christian perspective or the biblical worldview, as understood by the scholars who study these, the theologians, the philosophers, and then what the Urantia Papers say. But first, we're going to continue on with the debate about the miraculous. And in this debate today, we're going to listen to the debate between Christopher Hitchens, an atheist, a journalist, and an author. He will be in debate with Dr. John Lennox, the Oxford mathematician, who also was on our program last week, speaking to the Veritas Forum at Harvard. He'll join us again today with some more ideas. So let's continue on with that. And as an introduction, I would like to read from Christopher Hitchens' 2007 book called God is Not Great. On page 141, Christopher Hitchens writes this: assuming that a miracle is a favorable change in the natural order, the last word on the subject was written by Scottish philosopher David Hume, who granted us free will in the matter. A miracle is a disturbance or interruption in the expected and established course of things. This could involve anything from the sun rising in the west to an animal suddenly bursting into the recitation of verse. Very well then, free will also involves decision. If you seem to witness such a thing, there are two possibilities. The first is that the law of nature has been suspended in your favor. Or that the second is that you are under a misapprehension or suffering from a delusion. Thus, the likelihood of the second must be weighed against the likelihood of the first. Now, the Urantia Papers have something quite profound to say about that. So here, in paper 102, section 8, we read and hear this.
8. The evidences of religion. The highest evidence of the reality and efficacy of religion consists in the fact of human experience, namely that man, naturally fearful and suspicious, innately endowed with a strong instinct of self-preservation and craving survival after death, is willing fully to trust the deepest interests of his present and future to the keeping and direction of that power and person designated by his faith as God. That is the one central truth of all religion. As to what that power or person requires of man in return for this watch care and final salvation, no two religions agree. In fact, they all more or less disagree. Regarding the status of any religion in the evolutionary scale, it may best be judged by its moral judgments and its ethical standards. The higher the type of any religion, the more it encourages and is encouraged by a constantly improving social morality and ethical culture. We cannot judge religion by the status of its accompanying civilization. We had better estimate the real nature of a civilization by the purity and nobility of its religion. Many of the world's most notable religious teachers have been virtually unlettered. The wisdom of the world is not necessary to an exercise of saving faith in eternal realities. The difference in the religions of various ages is wholly dependent on the difference in man's comprehension of reality and on his differing recognition of moral values, ethical relationships, and spirit realities. Ethics is the eternal social or racial mirror which faithfully reflects the otherwise unobservable progress of internal spiritual and religious developments. Man has always thought of God in the terms of the best he knew, his deepest ideas and highest ideals. Even historic religion has always created its God conceptions out of its highest recognized values. Every intelligent creature gives the name of God to the best and highest thing he knows. Religion, when reduced to terms of reason and intellectual expression, has always dared to criticize civilization and evolutionary progress as judged by its own standards of ethical culture and moral progress. While personal religion precedes the evolution of human morals, it is regretfully recorded that institutional religion has invariably lagged behind the slowly changing mores of the human race. Organized religion has proved to be conservatively tardy. The prophets have usually led the people in religious development. The theologians have usually held them back. Religion, being a matter of inner or personal experience, can never develop very far in advance of the intellectual evolution of the races. But religion is never enhanced by an appeal to the so-called miraculous. The quest for miracles is a harking back to the primitive religions of magic. True religion has nothing to do with alleged miracles, and never does revealed religion point to miracles as proof of authority. Religion is ever and always rooted and grounded in personal experience. And your highest religion, the life of Jesus, was just such a personal experience, man, mortal man, seeking God and finding him to the fullness during one short life in the flesh, while in the same human experience there appeared God seeking man and finding him to the full satisfaction of the perfect soul of infinite supremacy. And that is religion, even the highest yet revealed in the universe of Nevadon, the earth life of Jesus of Nazareth.
Dr. John Lennox will respond. Let's proceed with this debate. Then we'll move on to the miracles of Jesus.
Will you promise to do it quickly?
So if your wife is pregnant and you know it's not you, the only alternative is that it's the Holy Spirit.
That's a false...
David Hume deals with this quite well. He says, in the case of the laws of nature being suspended, you have to ask yourself, have they been suspended in my favor, or am I possibly under a misapprehension? I think it's Thomas Paine who asks, which is more likely, that the laws of nature are suspended or that a Jewish girl should tell a fib? We have to grow up out of this stuff, you know. Now, your problem, Dr. Lennox, John, if I may say so,
is not
with me. Your problem is with Monsignor Ronald Knox, one of the greatest Christian apologists, first an Anglican, then an Anglo-Catholic, then finally a Roman Catholic, who in his book of apologetics very directly says Jesus of Nazareth never claimed to be God. It's not my problem. He claimed sometimes to be the Son, or let people run away with that idea. And to Jews, he was asked, when he was asked the direct question, are you the expected one, the awaited one, the one we want, the Messiah? He gave a slightly evasive, but they thought, profane answer. Now, this is my account of this is correct, I'm sorry to say.
Okay, I think
I regret to say.
I just hate to cut off a good conversation, but I'll give you one last...
I'm fascinated that he quotes David Hume and talking about the suspension of nature. David Hume has got about the worst analysis of miracles I've ever read in my life. First of all, he didn't really believe in the law of cause and effect on which you base laws of nature. Secondly, the laws of nature are not suspended in a miracle. It's God feeds a new event in. If I put £100 plus £100 or $100 in my drawer tonight, 100 plus 100 is 200. If I find $50 in the drawer tomorrow, I don't say the laws of arithmetic have been broken. I say the laws of Alabama have been broken.
Okay.
But let me make the point from finished.
Then you admit there is no conundrum.
No.
There's no problem to be solved in that case.
Yes, my knowledge
there's
of
nothing
the
to be
law.
Explained.
There is. The knowledge...
Not if it's covered by the laws of Alabama, it isn't.
But just a second. My knowledge that 1 plus 1 equals 2, I know that law, so to speak, tells me that another event has been fed into the system. And that's exactly what happens. My knowledge that dead men don't normally rise by observation means... that if one does rise, not the laws of nature have been suspended or broken, but God who created the universe And built into it those laws which are not causes but are descriptions of regularities. He's perfectly free, of course, as the creator, to feed a new event in, and then the laws of nature take over and a baby is born 9 months later.
Of course.
I think Hume is completely wrong about this.
Of course.
So in his book, God is Not Great, and in the conclusion of that book, entitled The Need for a New Enlightenment, by which I also agree, Christopher Hitchin, quoting from Gerhard Leasing, who wrote this in 1778, wrote these words, "The true value of a man is not determined by his possession, supposed or real, of truth, but rather by his sincere exertion to get to the truth. It is not possession of the truth, but rather the pursuit of truth by which he extends his powers and in which his ever-growing perfectibility is to be found. Possession makes one passive, indolent, and proud." Let us continue with Dr. John Lennox at the Veritas Forum speaking at Harvard. Here, Dr. Lennox.
I'm interested to see that the motto of your university is the word that stands behind me tonight, Veritas, which indicates that the founders were interested in truth. Of course, all of us must start somewhere. And I started in the small country of Northern Ireland. My parents were Christian, but they were not sectarian, and they gave me the greatest gift that a parent can give to his child. They allowed me to think. But when I arrived in Cambridge, in my first week as a student, someone said to me, "Do you believe in God?" And then they said, "Oh, sorry, I forgot you're Irish." "All you people believe in God and you fight about it." That was a turning point in my life. Because I was interested in truth, could it be that my faith in God was simply a product of Irish genetics? And so on that day, I decided to get to know people that did not share my worldview and befriend them. And I have been doing it ever since. I have spent a lot of time in Eastern Europe, in the communist time during the Cold War, and more laterally, because I speak Russian, spending time in Russia discussing these things in the academies of science. And one of the questions that keeps cropping up is the question that you've invited me to talk about tonight. Miracles is belief in the supernatural, irrational. Now, there are several concepts here, and the major one, of course, is the word miracle, which comes from the Latin miraculum, something wondered at. Now, of course, I'm aware it has a weaker meaning, like, it was a miracle that she passed her exams at Harvard, since she never seemed to do any work. You will be mistaken if you think that is the topic I'm going to address this evening. The Oxford English Dictionary describes a miracle as a marvelous event occurring within human experience which cannot have been brought about by human power or by the operation of any natural agency, and must therefore be ascribed to the special intervention of the deity or some supernatural being. Now, of course, if there is no such thing as a supernatural being or supernature, there is no need to discuss miracle. And they're not quite the same thing. So the antecedent question that we need to discuss is, first of all, is there a supernature? Or is nature that we observe all that exists? In other words, we have to face the question of the existence of God. Now, if you've been following the British newspapers, as I hope you do every day, of course, You will discover that Richard Dawkins is all over the front pages all this week, militantly proclaiming that atheism is essentially the default position. He, as the acknowledged leader of the New Atheists, is determined to show that science has rendered belief in all supernatural gods impossible. His book, The God Delusion, is directed explicitly against the concept of the supernatural. And he wishes to use science to abolish religion. Now, of course, not all atheists are extreme as Dawkins. Jürgen Habermas, the leading German intellectual who's an atheist, regards religion as an important source for creating meaning. And indeed, he warns Europe that our educational system, our legal system, our human rights are all derivative from the Judeo-Christian tradition. And interestingly, he, as a leading intellectual atheist on the continent, adds, to this day we have no other source. Everything else is post-modern chatter. That's a fascinating statement for an intellectual atheist. And I was reminded of that origin of our educational institutions as I looked up at your magnificent philosophy building, the only one in the world I've ever seen to bear the inscription, "What is man that you are mindful of him?" Ladies and gentlemen, students of Harvard, you stand in a tradition that at its inception saw no contradiction between the highest intellectual aspirations and belief in God, even in the philosophy department. I don't know what it's like now. But certainly, they did not believe then that belief in God was an insult to the intellect. Now, the new atheists are determined to spread the myth that science and belief in God are incompatible. I say myth because it's very easy to see that that is far too simplistic an analysis. How can science and belief in God be essentially incompatible when, for instance, so many leading scientists at my own University of Oxford believe in God? I can name the heads of several scientific departments, world famous in their fields, nanotechnology, electrical engineering, and so on, who are believers in God. And in this country, just to name one, William Phillips, Nobel Prize winner for physics, is a believer in God. And what I simply observe is this, that brilliant science can be done by atheists, and brilliant science can be done by believers in God, which shows us, ladies and gentlemen, that the conflict, which is real, lies much deeper in. It is not simplistically between science and belief in God and the supernatural. It is between two worldviews, two concepts of the nature of ultimate reality. And it is against that background that I wish to make my remarks. The one worldview is naturalism or materialism, there's very little difference between them, which believes that this universe is all that exists, or the multiverse. And that has implications for the nature of explanation. It means that explanation, by definition, must be reductionist from the bottom up, because there is no transcendence, there is no ultimate top-down causation. That was the view of Democritus and Leucippus in the ancient world. But also in that Greek melting pot, there were philosophers like Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, and they did not accept that view. They believed there was transcendence, there was something more. And those two views come barreling up through history, and they divide us in this room tonight, and they divide the professors in the academy, both in Oxford and in Cambridge, in England and in Massachusetts. So what we're talking about, ladies and gentlemen, is worldviews, belief systems, each of them. The one is naturalism and the other is theism. And it's just here that we encounter the first confusion. When I debated Princeton professor Peter Singer in Australia recently, he started by saying to us that his chief objection to religious belief was that people remained in the faith in which they'd been brought up. And of course, I was a prime example. So just to redress the balance, I asked him publicly about his parents. I said, "Peter, were your parents atheists?" And he said, "Yes, they were." So I said, "You remained in the faith in which you were brought up then." "Oh, but," he said, "it isn't a faith." "Oh," I said, "I was under the impression you believed it." Now, ladies and gentlemen, that little spat, and I got on very well with Peter Singer, you can watch the debate online, is very revealing, because it's consistent with the attitude of the new atheist to regard religious faith as faith, and therefore, by definition, believing where there is no evidence. But atheism isn't a faith. And of course, any philosopher could point out to them how trivial that is. It is very important to see that we are dealing with two belief systems. One believes that this universe is the ultimate reality, mass energy. The other believes that God is the ultimate reality. And the burning question is, what evidence is there for the veritas of either of them? The truth of either of them? And in particular, what way does science point? And therefore we need to be clear that the kind of faith that the new atheists are describing is what most of us would call blind faith. It's dangerous, of course. But faith, in its ordinary dictionary sense, derives from the word fides. It means trust. And all of us know that we don't usually trust people unless we're gullible, unless there's evidence to do so. We don't trust the banks either, unless there's evidence to do so, but that's another story. But the banking crisis has at least taught all of us the difference between evidence-based faith and non-evidence-based faith. And now, I cannot, of course, speak for other religions. They must rightly speak for themselves. But I'd like to make it very clear that Christianity is an evidence-based faith. One of the central statements of the Gospel of John is, "These things are written," he said, "that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name." In other words, here's the evidence, I've selected it, in order for it to provide a basis for your trust, for your confidence, for your faith. I'll come back to the matter of faith later. But having talked briefly about that, I want to address this question quite rapidly. What way does science point? I claim that science points towards God. The atheists claim it points in the opposite direction. And I want to bring as witnesses, first of all, history. It is no accident that when Harvard was founded, belief in God was written into its motto and onto its philosophy building. Because historians of science, like my colleague at Oxford, my former colleague John Headley Brooke, usually, most of them, will agree with what's called Merton's thesis. And the best formulation of it, I think, is due to C.S. Lewis, who said that men became scientific. Why? Because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. And the great pioneers of science, Galileo, Kepler, Newton, Clark Maxwell, Babbage, and so on, were all believers in God. I can remember I had the opportunity to give the very first lecture on this topic in Novosibirsk in Siberia. Quite a few members of the KGB in front of me. And I was invited by the provost, I think that's what you call them over here, I was invited by him to give a lecture on why a mathematician believes in God. It was the very first lecture on that topic in the university in 75 years. And when I started talking about the history of science and the fact that Newton and Galileo were believers, I noticed anger rising in the front row of heavyweight professors. So I stopped and I said, "What's the matter?" And they said, why were we never told this? And I said, can't you guess? They'd never been told. It was totally new to them that the founders of science were believers in God. Now you laugh, but actually we need to think carefully about the implications of that. Because the one thing it demonstrates is that belief in God and supernature were not at the beginning incompatible with science in the slightest degree. It was exactly the opposite. So what has happened? Why is it that I'm even having to give a lecture on this topic in Harvard? Why isn't it that we do still believe that there's something more than the natural world, if there is such a deep-seated harmony between science and belief in God? Well, first of all, there is a confusion about the reach of science. Alex Rosenberg, in his book, The Atheist's Guide to Reality, says, the mistake is to think that there is any more to reality than the laws of nature that science discovers. Scientism, in other words, is the reigning view. The idea that science is the only way to truth. Now we're immediately into the realms of epistemology. And Bertrand Russell summarized this viewpoint by saying, what science cannot tell us, mankind cannot know. Now Russell was quite a brilliant logician, but his logic failed him badly when he made that statement. What science cannot tell us, mankind cannot know. Is that a statement of science? No, so that we cannot know it. Is it too late for logic? This is what we call a logically incoherent statement. If it's true, it's false. You can work it out afterwards. Far more sensible is the view of Nobel Prize winner Sir Peter Medawar, who said it's so easy to see the limits of science. It cannot answer the questions of a child. Where am I coming from? What is the meaning of life? Where am I going to? We need to go outside science. So point number one, major point number one, ladies and gentlemen, is science does not define the limit of rationality. Rationality is bigger than science. Einstein, of course, saw it clearly. He said you can speak of the ethical foundations of science, but you cannot speak of the scientific foundations of ethics. He saw that there was a realm into which science couldn't go. And of course, that's obvious in Harvard, isn't it? I do believe you still have some humanities faculties left, don't you? Because if science was the only way to truth, you'd have to shut them tomorrow. And I don't think you'd want to do that, and neither would I. This scientism is extremely limited. The second thing is a confusion about the nature of explanation. I'm talking about God, ladies and gentlemen, but I wanted to be very clear to you what I mean by God. Because it seems to me that a great deal of atheist confusion today is that their concept of God is not one that I would share for a moment. Their idea of God is a God of the gaps. Again, in Novosibirsk, I remember I was severely attacked. I tend to be severely attacked. By a professor. He said, he came up to the blackboard and he drew a stroke of lightning. And he said, this is absurd what we're listening to. You see, the ancients used to believe that the gods were behind this. And then we did a bit of atmospheric physics and we found it wasn't the gods. Exit space for God. And that's the concept of the God of the gaps. I can't explain it, therefore God did it. Bit more science, a bit less space for God. Now, if you believe in a God like that, it's clear that you've got to make a choice between God and science. Because as science increases, by definition, God decreases. But what if you don't believe in a God like that? I certainly don't. My God is not a God of the gaps, he's the God of the whole show. So that when Isaac Newton discovered his law of gravitation, he didn't say, wonderful, I've now got a law and a mathematical description of how it works, I don't need God. He didn't do that. What he did was write the most brilliant book in the history of science, the Principia Mathematica, expressing the hope that it would persuade the thinking person to believe in God. In other words, the more he understood of science, the more he admired the genius of the God who did it that way.
For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at veritas.org.
Thank you, Professor Lennox. Now, just to underline or underscore the salient point in the discussion of the miraculous, I would like once again to quote the last two paragraphs of paper 102 of the Urantia paper, section 8, with these words.
While personal religion precedes the evolution of human morals, it is regretfully recorded that institutional religion has invariably lagged behind the slowly changing mores of the human race. Organized religion has proved to be conservatively tardy. The prophets have usually led the people in religious development. The theologians have usually held them back. Religion, being a matter of inner or personal experience, can never develop very far in advance of the intellectual evolution of the races. But religion is never enhanced by an appeal to the so-called miraculous. The quest for miracles is a harking back to the primitive religions of magic. True religion has nothing to do with alleged miracles, and never does revealed religion point to miracles as proof of authority. Religion is ever and always rooted and grounded in personal experience. And your highest religion, the life of Jesus, was just such a personal experience, man, mortal man, seeking God, and finding him to the fullness during one short life in the flesh. While in the same human experience there appeared God seeking man and finding him to the full satisfaction of the perfect soul of infinite supremacy. And that is religion, even the highest yet revealed in the universe of Nebadon, the earth life of Jesus of Nazareth.
So, there you have it. We'll return to the debate next week in our next episode. But for now, let's now return to investigation into the miracles of Jesus. And we begin now where we left off. So just a reminder that we're following the chronological order as laid out in the Urantia papers. It seems to have the movements of Jesus, the miracles of Jesus, the parables of Jesus, all in a more uniform order than we find in the New Testament. But we're following the New Testament miracles. So here, we begin with the miracle designated the centurion's servant. This took place, according to the Urantia papers, in AD 28 in Capernaum. It is outlined in Matthew 8, verse 8 to 13, and in Luke 7, 1 to 10. The occasion was that they were getting ready to make their way to Jerusalem, when a captain of the Roman guard sought out the rulers of the synagogue in order to interest Jesus on behalf of his servant. Here, we pick up from the Bible Heritage Foundation the story of Jesus, this miracle, as outlined in the New Testament.
Chapter 54, Healing the Centurion's Servant. After Jesus had finished preaching, teaching, and speaking the parables to all the multitudes, he went down the mountain and entered Capernaum. The multitudes followed him, and when he was entering the city, he was greeted by a delegation of Jews who were petitioning for a centurion. The centurion had a servant who was sick to the point of death. The Jews came to Jesus and asked him to heal the centurion's servant, because the centurion was a man that loved the nation Israel and had even built a synagogue for the Jews with his own money. Jesus agreed to go with them to heal the centurion's servant. But as he approached the centurion's home, the centurion sent out some friends ahead of him to ask Jesus not to trouble himself by coming into his home. He then came to Jesus and said he did not feel that he was worthy for Jesus to enter his home, nor was he worthy to meet Jesus himself. He asked Jesus to just say a word and his servant would be healed. He told Jesus that he was a man who had authority over him, and he knew how to obey, and that he had authority over others, and he knew how to be obeyed. When Jesus heard this, he marveled at him, and turned to the multitude that followed him and said to them, "Truly, I say to you, I have not found faith this great, not in Israel. I tell you the truth, that many will come from the east and the west, and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom shall be cast into outer darkness, where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth." Jesus said to the centurion, "Go your way, it has been done just as you believed." And when the centurion returned to his house, he found his servant healed and whole.
Now, let's listen to this exact same episode from the perspective of the Urantia paper, our third voice, our third witness in this investigation. Not as a point of criticism, but as a point of clarification to see exactly how the Urantia papers expands and fills in many of the gaps and clears up many of the misunderstandings around each and every one of these miracles. Let's have a listen. Paper 147, Miracle of Jesus the Centurion's Servant.
Paper 147, The Interlude Visit to Jerusalem. Jesus and the apostles arrived in Capernaum on Wednesday, March 17, and spent 2 weeks at the Bethsaida headquarters before they departed for Jerusalem. These 2 weeks, the apostles taught the people by the seaside, while Jesus spent much time alone in the hills about his Father's business. During this period, Jesus, accompanied by James and John Zebedee, made 2 secret trips to Tiberias, where they met with the believers and instructed them in the gospel of the kingdom. Many of the household of Herod believed in Jesus and attended these meetings. It was the influence of these believers among Herod's official family that had helped to lessen that ruler's enmity toward Jesus. These believers at Tiberias had fully explained to Herod that the kingdom, which Jesus proclaimed, was spiritual in nature and not a political venture. Herod rather believed these members of his own household, and therefore did not permit himself to become unduly alarmed by the spreading abroad of the reports concerning Jesus' teaching and healing. He had no objections to Jesus' work as a healer or religious teacher. Notwithstanding the favorable attitude of many of Herod's advisers, and even of Herod himself, there existed a group of his subordinates who were so influenced by the religious leaders at Jerusalem that they remained bitter and threatening enemies of Jesus and the apostles and, later on, did much to hamper their public activities. The greatest danger to Jesus lay in the Jerusalem religious leaders and not in Herod. And it was for this very reason that Jesus and the apostles spent so much time and did most of their public preaching in Galilee rather than at Jerusalem and in Judea. 1. The Centurion's Servant. On the day before they made ready to go to Jerusalem for the feast of the Passover, Mangus, a centurion or captain of the Roman guard stationed at Capernaum, came to the rulers of the synagogue saying, "My faithful orderly is sick and at the point of death. Would you therefore go to Jesus in my behalf and beseech him to heal my servant?" The Roman captain did this because he thought the Jewish leaders would have more influence with Jesus. So the elders went to see Jesus, and their spokesman said, "Teacher, we earnestly request you to go over to Capernaum and save the favorite servant of the Roman centurion, who is worthy of your notice because he loves our nation and even built us the very synagogue wherein you have so many times spoken." And when Jesus had heard them, he said, "I will go with you." And as he went with them over to the centurion's house, and before they had entered his yard, the Roman soldier sent his friends out to greet Jesus, instructing them to say, "Lord, trouble not yourself to enter my house, for I am not worthy that you should come under my roof. Neither did I think myself worthy to come to you, wherefore I sent the elders of your own people. But I know that you can speak the word where you stand, and my servant will be healed. For I am myself under the orders of others, and I have soldiers under me, and I say, to this one go, and he goes, to another come, and he comes, and to my servants do this or do that, and they do it." And when Jesus heard these words, he turned and said to his apostles and those who were with them, "I marvel at the belief of the Gentile. Verily, verily, I say to you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel." Jesus, turning from the house, said, "Let us go hence." And the friends of the centurion went into the house and told Mangus what Jesus had said. And from that hour the servant began to mend and was eventually restored to his normal health and usefulness. But we never knew just what happened on this occasion. This is simply the record, and as to whether or not invisible beings ministered healing to the centurion's servant was not revealed to those who accompanied Jesus. We only know of the fact of the servant's complete recovery. 2. The Journey to Jerusalem. Early on the morning of Tuesday, March 30, Jesus and the apostolic party started on their journey to Jerusalem for the Passover, going by the route of the Jordan Valley. They arrived on the afternoon of Friday, April 2, and established their headquarters, as usual, at Bethany. Passing through Jericho, they paused to rest while Judas made a deposit of some of their common funds in the bank of a friend of his family. This was the first time Judas had carried a surplus of money, and this deposit was left undisturbed until they passed through Jericho again, when on that last and eventful journey to Jerusalem, just before the trial and death of Jesus. The party had an uneventful trip to Jerusalem, but they had hardly got themselves settled at Bethany when from near and far those seeking healing for their bodies, comfort for their troubled minds, and salvation for their souls began to congregate, so much so that Jesus had little time for rest. Therefore they pitched tents at Gethsemane, and the Master would go back and forth from Bethany to Gethsemane to avoid the crowds which so constantly thronged him. The apostolic party spent almost 3 weeks at Jerusalem, but Jesus enjoined them to do no public preaching, only private teaching and personal work. At Bethany, they quietly celebrated the Passover, and this was the first time that Jesus and all of the 12 partook of the bloodless Passover feast. The apostles of John did not eat the Passover with Jesus and his apostles. They celebrated the feast with Abner and many of the early believers in John's preaching. This was the second Passover Jesus had observed with his apostles in Jerusalem. When Jesus and the 12 departed for Capernaum, the apostles of John did not return with them. Under the direction of Abner, they remained in Jerusalem and the surrounding country, quietly laboring for the extension of the kingdom, while Jesus and the 12 returned to work in Galilee. Never again were the 24 all together until a short time before the commissioning and sending forth of the 70 evangelists. But the two groups were cooperative, and notwithstanding their differences of opinion, the best of feelings prevailed.
So, now you'll see that we're going to be doing something slightly different. We'll take each of these miracles separately, and we'll discuss the New Testament version, and then we'll follow it up with an expansion on that by the Urantia Papers. Now, miracle number 9, the pool at Bethsaida. Same time, year AD 28, this time in Jerusalem. What was going on, or the backstory that was taking place, according to the Urantia Papers, was that the Apostle John was getting impatient. He wanted something to happen. So he led Jesus down to the pool of Bethsaida, hoping that Jesus would be constrained to work some kind of action, some kind of miracle. This miracle is recorded in John 5. And here we'll follow it up again with paper 147 from the Urantia Papers. Let's have a listen.
The Story of Jesus, Part 5, Second Passover to the Third. Chapter 37, Jesus Heals on the Sabbath. The time of the year had come for the Feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. There was in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool, which in the Hebrew is called Bethesda. The pool had 5 porches. In these porches were multitudes of sick, blind, halt, and withered. And there was a man who had been there for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there, he knew that he had been there for a long time. And Jesus said to the man, "Do you want to be made whole?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I don't have anyone to put me in the pool when the waters are troubled. Someone always goes in ahead of me." Jesus said to the man, "Stand up, take up your bed, and walk." And immediately the man was made whole, took up his bed, and walked. Jesus healed this man on the Sabbath. When the Jews saw the man carrying his bed, they stopped him and told him that it was not lawful for him to carry his bed on the Sabbath. But the man answered them and said, "The man that healed me told me to take up my bed and walk." "Who is this man that told you to take up your bed and walk?" they asked. The man who had been healed did not know who the man was because Jesus had left the area. Afterwards, Jesus found the man in the temple and said to him, "Look, you are made whole. Sin no more, or else a worse thing will happen to you." The man went away and found the Jews and told them that it was Jesus that had made him whole. Learning this, the Jews began to persecute Jesus because he did this work on the Sabbath. Jesus answered them and said, "My Father is working even up until this moment, and I will work also." The Jews took great insult at what Jesus said and became determined to kill him. They were angry because he made himself equal to God, not just that he healed a man on the Sabbath. Jesus said to them, "Listen carefully to the truth I am going to declare to you. The Son of Man can do nothing of himself except what he sees the Father doing. Whatever the Father does, the Son will do the same. The Father loves the Son and shows him all the things that he does. And even greater work than what you have already seen will be done, so that you will marvel. Just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, in the same way the Son will also give life to whoever he will. The Father is not going to judge any man. He has given the authority to judge to the Son, so that all may honor the Son, even as they honor the Father. The person who does not honor the Son does not honor the Father that sent him. Listen carefully to the truth I am going to declare to you. The hour is coming, and now is, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God. Those that hear will live, just as the Father has life in himself. In the same way he has given life to the Son, and he has given the authority to execute judgment, because he is the Son of Man. Don't be amazed at what I am saying to you. The hour is coming when all that are in the graves will hear his voice, and they will come forth, those that have done good to the resurrection of life, and those that have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. By myself I can do nothing. I judge only according to what I hear from the Father. My judgment is right and perfect, because it expresses the will of my Father, and my Father is the one that sent me to do his will, and it is his will that I seek, not my own. If I bear witness of myself, then my witness is not true. It is the Father that bears witness, and I know that his witness is true. You have inquired of John the Baptist, and he has borne witness to the truth. But the witness that I received is not from a man. I am telling you these things so that you will be saved. John the Baptist was like an oil lamp that burns and shines light, and you were willing to rejoice for a short time in his light. But the witness that I have is greater and more convincing than that of John the Baptist, for the works that the Father has given me to accomplish are the very works that I do, and they testify of me, and they prove that the Father has sent me. The Father that sent me has borne witness of me, but you have not heard his voice at any time, nor have you seen his form. You do not have his words living in you, and this is evidenced by the fact that you do not believe on the one that the Father has sent. You search the Scriptures because you think in them you will find eternal life. These are the very Scriptures that testify and bear witness about me. You will not come to me in order that you might have life. I do not receive glory from men. I know you, and you do not have the love of God living in you. I have come in my Father's name, and you will not receive me. If someone comes in their name, you will receive them. How can you believe when you receive glory from one another, but refuse to seek the glory that comes from God? Don't think that it is necessary for me to bring accusations against you to my Father. There is already one that accuses you, and his name is Moses, the very one you have set your hopes on. If you really believe Moses, then you would believe me, because he wrote about me. But since you do not believe what Moses wrote, how can you believe my words?
A large crowd of sick people were lying on the porches. The blind, the lame, and the paralyzed. A man was there who had been sick for 38 years. Jesus saw him lying there, and he knew that the man had been sick for such a long time.
Do you want to get well?
Sir, I don't have anyone here to put me in the pool when the water is stirred up. While I'm trying to get in, somebody else gets there first.
Get up. Pick up your mat and walk.
Immediately, the man got well. picked up his mat and started walking. The day this happened was a Sabbath, so the Jewish authorities told the man who had been healed,
"This is a Sabbath, and it is against our law for you to carry your mat."
"The man who made me well told me to pick up my mat and walk."
"Who is the man who told you to do this?"
But the man who had been healed did not know who Jesus was, for there was a crowd in that place, and Jesus had slipped away. Afterwards, Jesus found him in the temple.
"You're well now. Just stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you."
Then the man left and told the Jewish authorities that it was Jesus who had healed him. So they began to persecute Jesus because he had done this healing on a Sabbath. Jesus answered them,
"My Father is always working, and I too must work."
This saying made the Jewish authorities all the more determined to kill him. Not only had he broken the Sabbath law, but he had said that God was his own Father, and in this way had made himself equal with God. So Jesus answered them,
"I tell you the truth. The Son can do nothing on his own. He does only what he sees his Father doing. What the Father does, the Son also does."
3. At the Pool of Bethesda. The afternoon of the second Sabbath in Jerusalem, as the Master and the Apostles were about to participate in the temple services, John said to Jesus, "Come with me, I would show you something." John conducted Jesus out through one of the Jerusalem gates to a pool of water called Bethesda. Surrounding this pool was a structure of 5 porches, under which a large group of sufferers lingered in quest of healing. This was a hot spring, whose reddish-tinged water would bubble up at irregular intervals because of gas accumulations in the rock caverns underneath the pool. This periodic disturbance of the warm waters was believed by many to be due to supernatural influences, and it was a popular belief that the first person who entered the water after such a disturbance would be healed of whatever infirmity he had. The apostles were somewhat restless under the restrictions imposed by Jesus, and John, the youngest of the 12, was especially restive under this restraint. He had brought Jesus to the pool thinking that the sight of the assembled sufferers would make such an appeal to the Master's compassion that he would be moved to perform a miracle of healing, and thereby would all Jerusalem be astounded and presently be won to believe in the gospel of the kingdom. Said John to Jesus, "Master, see all of these suffering ones. Is there nothing we can do for them?" And Jesus replied, "John, why would you tempt me to turn aside from the way I have chosen? Why do you go on desiring to substitute the working of wonders and the healing of the sick for the proclamation of the gospel of eternal truth? My son, I may not do that which you desire, but gather together these sick and afflicted, that I may speak words of good cheer and eternal comfort to them." In speaking to those assembled, Jesus said, "Many of you are here, sick and afflicted, because of your many years of wrong living. Some suffer from the accidents of time, others as a result of the mistakes of their forebears, while some of you struggle under the handicaps of the imperfect conditions of your temporal existence. But my Father works, and I would work, to improve your earthly state, but more especially to ensure your eternal estate. None of us can do much to change the difficulties of life unless we discover the Father in heaven so wills. After all, we are all beholden to do the will of the Eternal. If you could all be healed of your physical afflictions, you would indeed marvel. But it is even greater that you should be cleansed of all spiritual disease and find yourselves healed of all moral infirmities. You are all God's children. You are the sons of the Heavenly Father. The bonds of time may seem to afflict you, but the God of eternity loves you. And when the time of judgment shall come, fear not, you shall all find not only justice, but an abundance of mercy. Verily, verily, I say to you, he who hears the gospel of the kingdom and believes in this teaching of sonship with God has eternal life. Already are such believers passing from judgment and death to light and life. And the hour is coming in which even those who are in the tombs shall hear the voice of the resurrection. And many of those who heard believed the gospel of the kingdom. Some of the afflicted were so inspired and spiritually revivified that they went about proclaiming that they had also been cured of their physical ailments. One man who had been many years downcast and grievously afflicted by the infirmities of his troubled mind rejoiced at Jesus' words and, picking up his bed, went forth to his home, even though it was the Sabbath day. This afflicted man had waited all these years for somebody to help him. He was such a victim of the feeling of his own helplessness that he had never once entertained the idea of helping himself, which proved to be the one thing he had to do in order to effect recovery, take up his bed and walk. Then said Jesus to John, "Let us depart, ere the chief priests and the scribes come upon us and take offense that we spoke words of life to these afflicted ones." And they returned to the temple to join their companions, and presently all of them departed to spend the night at Bethany. But John never told the other apostles of this visit of himself and Jesus to the pool of Bethesda on this Sabbath afternoon. 4. The Rule of Living. On the evening of this same Sabbath day, at Bethany, while Jesus, the 12, and a group of believers were assembled about the fire in Lazarus' garden, Nathanael asked Jesus this question, "Master, although you have taught us the positive version of the old rule of life, instructing us that we should do to others as we wish them to do to us, I do not fully discern how we can always abide by such an injunction. Let me illustrate my contention by citing the example of a lustful man who thus wickedly looks upon his intended consort in sin. How can we teach that this evil-intending man should do to others as he would they should do to him?" When Jesus heard Nathanael's question, he immediately stood upon his feet and, pointing his finger at the apostle, said, "Nathanael, Nathanael, what manner of thinking is going on in your heart? Do you not receive my teachings as one who has been born of the Spirit? Do you not hear the truth as men of wisdom and spiritual understanding? When I admonished you to do to others as you would have them do to you, I spoke to men of high ideals, not to those who would be tempted to distort my teaching into a license for the encouragement of evil doing." When the master had spoken, Nathanael stood up and said, "But master, you should not think that I approve of such an interpretation of your teaching. I ask the question because I conjectured that many such men might thus misjudge your admonition, and I hoped you would give us further instruction regarding these matters." And then, when Nathanael had sat down, Jesus continued speaking, "I well know, Nathanael, that no such idea of evil is approved in your mind. But I am disappointed in that you all so often fail to put a genuinely spiritual interpretation upon my commonplace teachings, instruction which must be given you in human language, and as men must speak. Let me now teach you concerning the differing levels of meaning attached to the interpretation of this rule of living, this admonition to do to others that which you desire others to do to you. 1. The level of the flesh. Such a purely selfish and lustful interpretation would be well exemplified by the supposition of your question. 2. The level of the feelings. This plane is one level higher than that of the flesh, and implies that sympathy and pity would enhance one's interpretation of this rule of living. 3. The level of mind. Now come into action the reason of mind and the intelligence of experience. Good judgment dictates that such a rule of living should be interpreted in consonance with the highest idealism embodied in the nobility of profound self-respect. 4. The level of brotherly love. Still higher is discovered the level of unselfish devotion to the welfare of one's fellows. On this higher plane of wholehearted social service growing out of the consciousness of the fatherhood of God and the consequent recognition of the brotherhood of man, there is discovered a new and far more beautiful interpretation of this basic rule of life. 5. The moral level. And then when you attain true philosophic levels of interpretation, when you have real insight into the rightness and wrongness of things, when you perceive the eternal fitness of human relationships, you will begin to view such a problem of interpretation as you would imagine a high-minded, idealistic, wise, and impartial third person would so view and interpret such an injunction as applied to your personal problems of adjustment to your life situations. 6. The spiritual level. And then, last but greatest of all, we attain the level of spirit insight and spiritual interpretation, which impels us to recognize in this rule of life the divine command to treat all men as we conceive God would treat them. That is the universe ideal of human relationships. And this is your attitude toward all such problems when your supreme desire is ever to do the Father's will. I would, therefore, that you should do to all men that which you know I would do to them in like circumstances. Nothing Jesus had said to the apostles up to this time had ever more astonished them. They continued to discuss the Master's words long after he had retired. While Nathanael was slow to recover from his supposition that Jesus had misunderstood the spirit of his question, the others were more than thankful that their philosophic fellow apostle had had the courage to ask such a thought-provoking question.
So we can see here how the Urantia Papers expand and clarify the story that is outlined briefly in the New Testament. We also understand why this particular story is only in the Gospel of John. We understand here that Jesus did not work a wholesale miracle as John had desired, but he did teach a group a valuable lesson on nature and on human affliction. And he also got some time to proclaim his gospel. The one man who was apparently cured probably suffered from some sort of either emotional or mental trouble, and at last he was able to take up his bed and walk, just as soon as he had exercised enough faith and enough courage to do it on his own. The lesson, of course, is that we should not depend on others to do those things that we can do for ourselves. We see that Jesus hurrying away didn't want to cause any trouble with the Jewish rulers at that particular time. And so we can see how the Urantia Papers expand and clarify these stories. Now, let us move on to the story that is outlined in Matthew 12, from 9 to 4, Mark 3, verses 1 to 6, and Luke 6, 6 to 11. All three of the Synoptic Gospels tell this story of the man with the withered hand. Again, this is in AD 28, and it's back at Capernaum. Let's pick up that story and listen to the New Testament version and then the Urantia Papers.
Chapter 39, Healing on the Sabbath. On another Sabbath day, Jesus entered into a synagogue and began to teach. There was a man in the synagogue with a withered right hand. The scribes and the Pharisees watched to see if Jesus would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they would have something to bring as an accusation against him. So they asked Jesus, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day?" Jesus knew exactly what they were thinking and said to the man with the withered hand, "Stand up and walk to the middle of the congregation." So the man did as Jesus said. Then he began to speak to them. "What man here, having one sheep that falls into a pit on the Sabbath day, will not grab that sheep and pull it up out of the pit? How much more valuable is a man than a sheep?" Then Jesus said, "Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath day or to do harm, to save life or to destroy life?" The scribes and the Pharisees said nothing. Jesus looked around at the congregation and became angry and grieved at the hardness of their hearts. He said to the man in the midst of the assembly with the withered hand, "Stretch forth your hand." The man did as Jesus commanded. He stretched it forth and it was restored as whole as the other hand. The scribes and the Pharisees were filled with anger and fumed with one another what they should do to Jesus. The Pharisees went out and immediately began conspiring with the secular powers under the authority of King Herod to figure out how they might destroy Jesus.
7. The man with the withered hand. The second Sabbath before the departure of the apostles and the new corps of evangelists on the second preaching tour of Galilee, Jesus spoke in the Capernaum synagogue on the joys of righteous living. When Jesus had finished speaking, a large group of those who were maimed, halt, sick, and afflicted crowded up around him, seeking healing. Also in this group were the apostles, many of the new evangelists, and the Pharisaic spies from Jerusalem. Everywhere that Jesus went, except when in the hills about the Father's business, the six Jerusalem spies were sure to follow. The leader of the spying Pharisees, as Jesus stood talking to the people, induced a man with a withered hand to approach him and ask if it would be lawful to be healed on the Sabbath day, or should he seek help on another day. When Jesus saw the man, heard his words, and perceived that he had been sent by the Pharisees, he said, "Come forward while I ask you a question. If you had a sheep, and it should fall into a pit on the Sabbath day, would you reach down, lay hold on it, and lift it out? Is it lawful to do such things on the Sabbath day?" And the man answered, "Yes, Master, it would be lawful thus to do well on the Sabbath day." Then said Jesus, speaking to all of them, "I know wherefore you have sent this man into my presence. You would find cause for offense in me if you could tempt me to show mercy on the Sabbath day. In silence you all agreed that it was thus lawful to lift the unfortunate sheep out of the pit, even on the Sabbath. And I call you to witness that it is lawful to exhibit loving kindness on the Sabbath day, not only to animals, but also to men. How much more valuable is a man than a sheep? I proclaim that it is lawful to do good to men on the Sabbath day." And as they all stood before him in silence, Jesus, addressing the man with the withered hand, said, "Stand up here by my side, that all may see you. And now, that you may know that it is my Father's will that you do good on the Sabbath day, if you have faith to be healed, I bid you stretch out your hand." And as this man stretched forth his withered hand, it was made whole. The people were minded to turn upon the Pharisees, but Jesus bade them be calm, saying, "I have just told you that it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath, to save life, but I did not instruct you to do harm and give way to the desire to kill." The angered Pharisees went away, and notwithstanding it was the Sabbath day, they hastened forthwith to Tiberias and took counsel with Herod, doing everything in their power to arouse his prejudice in order to secure the Herodians as allies against Jesus. But Herod refused to take action against Jesus, advising that they carry their complaints to Jerusalem. This is the first case of a miracle to be wrought by Jesus in response to the challenge of his enemies. And the Master performed this so-called miracle not as a demonstration of his healing power, but as an effective protest against making the Sabbath rest of religion a veritable bondage of meaningless restrictions upon all mankind. This man returned to his work as a stonemason, proving to be one of those whose healing was followed by a life of thanksgiving and righteousness.
And here, for our final miracle for this investigation, this episode, we talk about the healing of the paralytic. Again, this is in the three synoptic gospels, in Matthew 9, verses 2 to 8, Mark 2, 1 to 12, and Luke 5, 17 to 26. The place is in the Zebedee home in Bethsaida, not far from Capernaum. The house is surrounded by a throng of people. The six Pharisee spies from Jerusalem are sitting on the front step practically, and Jesus is speaking when they lower this man through the roof and into his presence. Let's listen to the New Testament and then the Urantia Papers.
Chapter 35. Jesus Heals a Paralytic. After a while, Jesus entered Capernaum and began teaching. The crowds discovered that Jesus was in a certain house. The crowds trying to get into the house were so great that there was no room for anyone to even squeeze through the door. Jesus was teaching them all the Word of God. Pharisees and the doctors of the law had come from every village of Galilee and Judea and Jerusalem. Jesus was displaying the Lord's power, and many were being healed of all sorts of sickness and disease. Four men had carried a man in a bed that was sick of the palsy, but they couldn't reach Jesus because of all the crowds. So they carried the man up the stairs to the rooftop, where they uncovered the roof tiles and let the man down through the hole in the roof. They let him down right in the middle of the crowd where Jesus was teaching and healing. Jesus saw their faith and said to the man crippled by palsy, "Man, be of good cheer, your sins are forgiven." When certain of the scribes and Pharisees who were sitting near Jesus heard what Jesus said to the palsied, they began to reason in their minds and hearts and discuss among themselves what Jesus meant. "How can he say something like this? He is a blasphemer. Who is this person speaking blasphemies? Who can forgive sins? Only God can forgive a man's sins." Immediately Jesus, knowing in his spirit the way they were reasoning and what they were saying, and knowing their very thoughts, answered them and said, Why are you thinking evil thoughts in your heart? What is easier to say to the sick with the palsy? Your sins be forgiven you? Or to say, stand up and take up your bed and walk? But so that you will know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, he said to the man sick of the palsy, stand up and take your bed and go to your home. The man immediately stood up and took his bed and walked in front of everyone. He left for his house glorifying God. Everyone was amazed, and when the crowd saw what had happened, they were afraid. And then they were filled with excitement and began glorifying God who had given such authority to a man. They said, we have never seen anything like the strange things we have seen today. And they were filled with fear.
8. Last week at Bethsaida. The last week of the sojourn at Bethsaida, the Jerusalem spies became much divided in their attitude toward Jesus and his teachings. Three of these Pharisees were tremendously impressed by what they had seen and heard. Meanwhile, at Jerusalem, Abraham, a young and influential member of the Sanhedrin, publicly espoused the teachings of Jesus and was baptized in the pool of Siloam by Abner. All Jerusalem was agog over this event, and messengers were immediately dispatched to Bethsaida, recalling the six spying Pharisees. The Greek philosopher, who had been won for the kingdom on the previous tour of Galilee, returned with certain wealthy Jews of Alexandria, and once more they invited Jesus to come to their city for the purpose of establishing a joint school of philosophy and religion, as well as an infirmary for the sick. But Jesus courteously declined the invitation. About this time, there arrived at the Bethsaida encampment a trance prophet from Baghdad, one Kermeth. This supposed prophet had peculiar visions when in trance and dreamed fantastic dreams when his sleep was disturbed. He created a considerable disturbance at the camp, and Simon Zelotes was in favor of dealing rather roughly with the self-deceived pretender, but Jesus intervened and allowed him entire freedom of action for a few days. All who heard his preaching soon recognized that his teaching was not sound as judged by the gospel of the kingdom. He shortly returned to Baghdad, taking with him only a half dozen unstable and erratic souls. But before Jesus interceded for the Baghdad prophet, David Zebedee, with the assistance of a self-appointed committee, had taken Kermeth out into the lake and, after repeatedly plunging him into the water, had advised him to depart hence to organize and build a camp of his own. On this same day, Beth Marion, a Phoenician woman, became so fanatical that she went out of her head and, after almost drowning from trying to walk on the water, was sent away by her friends. The New Jerusalem convert, Abraham the Pharisee, gave all of his worldly goods to the apostolic treasury, and this contribution did much to make possible the immediate sending forth of the 100 newly trained evangelists. Andrew had already announced the closing of the encampment, and everybody prepared either to go home or else to follow the evangelists into Galilee. 9. Healing the paralytic. On Friday afternoon, October 1, when Jesus was holding his last meeting with the apostles, evangelists, and other leaders of the disbanding encampment, and with the six Pharisees from Jerusalem seated in the front row of this assembly in the spacious and enlarged front room of the Zebedee home, there occurred one of the strangest and most unique episodes of all Jesus' earth life. The Master was, at this time, speaking as he stood in this large room, which had been built to accommodate these gatherings during the rainy season. The house was entirely surrounded by a vast concourse of people who were straining their ears to catch some part of Jesus' discourse. While the house was thus thronged with people and entirely surrounded by eager listeners, a man long afflicted with paralysis was carried down from Capernaum on a small couch by his friends. This paralytic had heard that Jesus was about to leave Bethsaida, and having talked with Aaron the stonemason, who had been so recently made whole, he resolved to be carried into Jesus' presence where he could seek healing. His friends tried to gain entrance to Zebedee's house by both the front and back doors, but too many people were crowded together. But the paralytic refused to accept defeat. He directed his friends to procure ladders by which they ascended to the roof of the room in which Jesus was speaking, and, after loosening the tiles, they boldly lowered the sick man on his couch by ropes until the afflicted one rested on the floor immediately in front of the Master. When Jesus saw what they had done, he ceased speaking, while those who were with him in the room marveled at the perseverance of the sick man and his friends. Said the paralytic, Master, I would not disturb your teaching, but I am determined to be made whole. I am not like those who received healing and immediately forgot your teaching. I would be made whole that I might serve in the kingdom of heaven. Now, notwithstanding that this man's affliction had been brought upon him by his own misspent life, Jesus, seeing his faith, said to the paralytic, Son, fear not, your sins are forgiven. Your faith shall save you. When the Pharisees from Jerusalem, together with other scribes and lawyers who sat with them, heard this pronouncement by Jesus, they began to say to themselves, How dare this man thus speak? Does he not understand that such words are blasphemy? Who can forgive sin but God? Jesus, perceiving in his spirit that they thus reasoned within their own minds and among themselves, spoke to them, saying, Why do you so reason in your hearts? Who are you that you sit in judgment over me? What is the difference whether I say to this paralytic, Your sins are forgiven, or arise, take up your bed, and walk? But that you who witness all this may finally know that the Son of Man has authority and power on earth to forgive sins, I will say to this afflicted man, Arise, take up your bed, and go to your own house. And when Jesus had thus spoken, the paralytic arose, and as they made way for him, he walked out before them all. And those who saw these things were amazed. Peter dismissed the assemblage, while many prayed and glorified God, confessing that they had never before seen such strange happenings. And it was about this time that the messengers of the Sanhedrin arrived to bid the 6 spies return to Jerusalem. When they heard this message, they fell to earnest debate among themselves, and after they had finished their discussions, the leader and 2 of his associates returned with the messengers to Jerusalem, while 3 of the spying Pharisees confessed faith in Jesus and, going immediately to the lake, were baptized by Peter and fellowshipped by the apostles as children of the kingdom.
So, there you have it. So now, that completes this week's investigation into the miracles of Jesus, but we will continue next week. So join us next week as we investigate the miracles of Jesus as part of the story of Jesus, as part of the investigation into the New Testament Bible. Thank you. We'd like to thank the Cosmic Citizen. We'd like to thank the Urantia Book Fellowship. We'd like to thank the Bible Heritage Foundation for letting us use the story of Jesus. Thank you so much. Join us next week.